Welcome to IP Management Voice, the podcast spotlighting leading minds in IP and IP management. This series supports the IP Business Academy's call for subject matter experts to share insights, foster reflection, and strengthen the global IP system. Join the conversation via our newsletter and explore cutting-edge content on DPLEX. The content featured in this episode on judicial transparency, AI, and the future of legal predictability in Europe comes from Till Martin Boosman Welsh.
Welcome to a new deep dive. Today we are going to tackle a subject that, on the surface, sounds a bit like dry database administration.
It does.
We're looking at the availability of judicial data in the European Union. But before you skip ahead, I want to frame this differently because the sources we're looking at suggest this is actually a massive shift in how we understand the law itself.
It really is. It sounds technical, database management, you know, file formats, APIs. But what we're actually discussing is a change in the epistemology of jurisprudence.
Okay, epistemology of jurisprudence. You're hitting us with the heavy philosophy right out of the gate.
I am. But think about it this way. For centuries, law has been a hermeneutic discipline.
Framing. Interpretation.
Exactly. It's been about interpretation. You read a static text, you read a judgment, you think about these abstract principles of justice. It's almost an art form.
Right. You stare at the ceiling and you conjure the meaning of fairness.
Precisely. But now we're moving toward a data-driven science. We aren't just reading the law anymore. We are quantifying the sociological reality of how the law is actually applied in the real world.
So less about the spirit of the law and more about the stats of the law.
In a way, yes. It's the moneyballification of the courtroom. And if you're an IP expert listening to this or someone in legal tech, this matters because it shifts your job from finding a single precedent to analyzing behavioral patterns at scale.
But, and there's always a but, this whole vision relies on one thing.
The data.
The data. And from what I've gathered reading through these reports, the state of judicial data in Europe is, well, messy feels like an understatement.
It's a mess. It's fragmented. It's inconsistent. And it's deeply tied to, you know, cultural identity. And that's the conflict we need to explore. We have the technology to analyze the law in action, but we don't necessarily have the raw materials.
It's interesting you say technology, because I think most of us assume this is a modern problem. You know, Silicon Valley invents AI, and then suddenly we decide to apply math to the law.
Right, that it's a 21st century invention.
Yeah, exactly.
You would think so. But one of the most fascinating things in the research is that this desire to turn law into a math problem is actually older than the steam engine.
Really? I assume this started with computers?
No, we have to go back to 1709.
1709. Okay. I definitely don't know who the legal tech guru of 1709 was.
His name was Nicholas Bernoulli. You might know the name from the famous family of mathematicians. He was a jurist and a mathematician, and he published a dissertation called De Usu Artis Conjectandi in Jure.
My Latin is a bit rusty. On the application of probability theory in law.
Spot on. He basically argued that legal uncertainty, you know, will I win this case, will I lose, could be mitigated using probability calculus. He wanted to bring mathematical rigor to the courtroom.
So why didn't catch on? Why aren't we all using the Bernoulli method today?
Data, or rather the lack of it. In 1709, information dissemination was incredibly slow. You couldn't build a data set large enough to calculate those probabilities. Court records were physical papers scattered across towns.
Right, it would take days to get from one to the other.
Exactly. So it just remained an academic curiosity.
So the math was ready, but the infrastructure wasn't.
Precisely. And if we jump forward to the 20th century, we see another attempt. This is where the sociological turn happens. There was a scholar named Eugen Ehrlich.
I have to admit, the name doesn't ring a bell. Who was Ehrlich?
He's effectively the godfather of the sociology of law. And he had this really radical idea for the time. He argued that if you want to understand the law, you can't just look at the statutes, what he called the law in books.
Because statutes are just words on a page.
Exactly. He said you have to look at the living law. How do people actually behave? How do courts actually rule when the rubber meets the road?
So less about the theory of justice and more about the mechanics of it.
Yes. And a contemporary of his, Arthur Nussbaum, proposed legal fact research in 1914. He wanted to use empirical methods observation, data collection, to study the law. But again, doing that manually is a nightmare.
Right. You'd need an army of clerks just reading millions of pages.
Which brings us to today. We finally have natural language processing, NLP, and machine learning. We finally have the tools to do what Bernoulli and Ehrlich dreamed of. We can structure that natural language and turn all that text into data.
Okay, so the dream is alive. We have the tools. But let's go back to that mess you mentioned, the whole garbage in, garbage out problem. If I'm a listener, maybe running a patent portfolio, and I buy some fancy analytics tool, how do I know if the data behind it is actually any good?
That is the critical question. The sources use a framework adapted from Wang and Strong. They were data quality experts back in the 90s to break this down. It's not enough to just say we have the data. You need to look at four specific metrics.
Okay, walk us through them. What's number one?
First is intrinsic quality. This is the baseline. Is the text accurate? Is it a trustworthy replica of the judgment? If the digitization process, introduces typos or cuts off paragraphs, the analysis is dead on arrival.
That seems pretty straightforward.
It is. But the second one is where people get tripped up. Contextual quality. And this is primarily about completeness.
Completeness meaning having every single case.
Yes. And this is crucial for our IP experts listening. Think about it in terms of patent litigation. If you use a database that only includes important cases, Supreme Court rulings, major appellate wins, you're looking at the outliers.
The top 1% that make the news.
Exactly. But if you are advising a client on risk or trying to predict the outcome of a standard infringement claim, you don't care about the outlier. You care about the 90% of cases that might get dismissed on procedural grounds in lower courts.
You need to know if a specific judge tends to throw out cases before they even get to trial.
Yes. And if your data set only includes the greatest hits selected by some legal editor, you completely miss that procedural reality. You're blind to the actual risk profile because of selection bias. To do Moneyball, you need the boring cases too.
That makes so much sense. You can't calculate a batting average if you only count the home runs. What's a third metric?
Representational quality. This is all about machine readability. Is the data structured?
I'm guessing most legal data is just PDFs, right?
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah.
And PDFs are a nightmare for computers. They're essentially digital pictures of paper. They lack structure. A machine has to, guess where the case number ends and then the judge's name begins. Good data needs to be in XML or JSON formats where all that metadata is tagged and separate from the text.
And the last one.
Accessibility. Can you get the data in bulk via an API, or do you have to click download on a website one file at a time?
Or get stopped by a paywall or one of those CAPTCHAs.
Exactly. So the ideal standard is accurate, complete, machine readable, and API accessible.
Okay, that sounds like a great standard. Now let's look at the map. We're in the EU. We talk a lot about the digital single market. So I assume every country is striving toward this standard in pretty much the same way.
Uh-huh. If only. That's the great irony here. Despite all the single market rhetoric, the landscape of judicial transparency is incredibly fractured. The research identifies three distinct clusters of countries, and they're all approaching this from completely different philosophical angles.
Okay, let's tour the map. Where do we find most transparent systems?
Surprisingly to many, you have to look east. Cluster A, countries like Slovakia and Romania.
Why the east? I would have guessed the Nordics or maybe Germany.
It comes down to history. In the post-Soviet era, these young democracies faced massive systemic corruption. Trust in the judiciary was near zero, so they adopted this glass house philosophy. Transparency wasn't a nice to have, it was a survival mechanism for the rule of law.
So they built it to prove they weren't hiding anything.
Exactly. And because they were building their digital infrastructure from scratch greenfield projects, they could bake transparency right in. Look at Slovakia. Following a judicial crisis, they mandated the publication of virtually all court decisions.
All of them.
Virtually all. And they went even further. They published data on judges' family ties within the judiciary and their property declarations.
Wow. So you can actually check if a judge has a cousin working in the same court.
Yes. NGOs actually use this data to build dashboards that rank judges on efficiency and quality. It's radical transparency.
That is intense. Okay, so that's cluster A. What about the West? Let's talk about France. I know they have a strong tech sector.
France is in cluster B. We call this progressive transformism. They're driven by digital sovereignty. They want the state to control the data, not private companies. But France has a fascinating paradox.
What's the paradox?
They mandate open data. They're pushing to publish everything. But at the same time, they have explicitly criminalized the use of that data to predict the behavior of individual judges.
Wait, hold on. They give you the data. But if you use it to say, Judge DuPont tends to rule for the plaintiff, you're breaking the law.
Correct.
How does that make any sense?
It's a cultural difference. It reflects the civil law ideal that the judge is an impersonal mouth of the law.
Ah.
In that tradition, a judge shouldn't have a personality. They shouldn't have biases. They are just applying the code.
So if you analyze them as individuals, you are insulting the system itself.
Effectively, yes. They want the transparency of the jurisprudence, the legal reasoning, but the anonymity of the magistrate. They're fighting against the profiling of judges.
That is a wild distinction. Here's all the data. Now, don't you dare analyze it. Okay, so where does that leave countries like Germany?
Germany and Sweden fall into cluster C, selective traditionalism.
Traditionalism sounds like slow.
It is. In Germany, the view is that publication is primarily for communicating precedent. It's for educational purposes. So they prioritize incredibly high quality manual anonymization.
Manual. So someone is literally sitting there with a black marker or the digital equivalent redacting names.
Yes. And because it's so resource intensive, they can't publish everything. They only publish what they deem legally relevant. Yeah. And this leads to what researchers call the dark figure of case law.
The dark figure. That sounds ominous.
It is. In Germany, it's estimated that over 99% of court decisions are never published.
Wait, back up. 99%.
99.
If I'm a lawyer in Munich, I'm effectively operating in the dark.
You're operating on intuition, gossip, and a tiny, tiny sliver of published precedents.
Mm-hmm.
You rely on the 1% of cases that were deemed interesting enough to publish. But here's the problem. Legally interesting usually means novel or unusual.
It's the exception to the rule.
Right. So the published data might actually teach you the wrong lesson about how a court normally handles a standard trademark dispute. You're training your own internal model on anomalies.
That is actually terrifying if you think about it. We call it a civil law system, but the text of the law isn't the whole story if you can't see how it's actually applied in the vast majority of cases.
And that is the core conflict. The East is building glass houses, France is forbidding you from looking at the residents of the glass house, and Germany is keeping the curtains drawn on 99% of the house.
But we're at a tipping point, aren't we?
Hey, are you an IP expert with a focus topic you want to share? Then you might be just the right fit to become an IP subject matter expert at the IP Business Academy. It's a great opportunity to build visibility for your expertise and reach new clients through a trusted academic platform. You'll be supported in creating digital content, LinkedIn strategies, and outreach to your target group. If you're ready to raise your profile and position yourself as a thought leader, get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. End of advertisement.
Because manual redaction, that whole German model, it just isn't sustainable if you want to tackle that dark figure.
No, it's not. The volume is just too high. If you want to publish the B-sides, the routine cases, you need automation. You need AI to handle the pseudonymization.
But introducing AI brings up the other big fear. We've all heard the horror stories of lawyers using ChatGPT and citing cases that just don't exist.
The hallucination problem, yes.
Right. So if we're moving to this data-driven science, how do we trust the machine?
This is where the tech is evolving rapidly. The industry is moving toward what we call grounded architectures. The sources point to a platform called Anita as a case study for this. It's trying to solve the black box problem using explainable AI, or XAO.
Okay, let's break that down. Explainable AI. How is that different from just asking a standard large language model a legal question?
Well, think of a standard LLM like a creative writer. It predicts the next word based on probability. It wants to write a sentence that sounds good. But in a legal context, you don't want a creative writer. You want a strict librarian.
You want someone who only speaks if they can point to the book on the shelf.
Exactly. Anita represents a shift toward design level control. So instead of just letting the model guess, the architecture forces the AI to follow a specific reasoning path. It cannot generate a claim unless it can pin a specific footnote to a specific document in the database.
So it's not just retrieval augmented generation, or R, which is the buzzword we usually hear.
It goes deeper. RAG is just find a document and summarize it. Mm-hmm. Design level control is about structuring the logic itself. It anchors the AI in the law in books, the verified text, while allowing it to analyze the law in action.
It effectively creates a chain of custody for the logic.
Yes. And that is the only way this technology will ever be accepted in a courtroom or in high-level IP strategy. You need to be able to click the link and see the source.
It's fascinating. We started with Bernoulli in 1709 failing because he didn't have the data.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have too much data, or at least too much to handle manually. And we are building AI just to make sense of it all.
It's the closing of a 300-year-old circle.
So let's bring this home for our listener. If I'm sitting in an IP firm today or working in legal tech, what is the so what here?
The so what is that the nature of your expertise is changing. For the IP expert, legal research is no longer about finding a needle in a haystack. It's about analyzing the entire haystack instantly.
And practically, that means better risk assessment.
Ideally, yes. It offers economic predictability. If you can quantify judicial tendencies, even the procedural ones, you can price risk better. You can tell a client, this court dismisses 60% of these claims before trial, rather than just saying, you know, I have a good feeling about this.
But we're still stuck with that fragmented map, aren't we?
We are. The trend is clearly pointing toward comprehensive publication and automated tools like Anita. I mean, the constitutional imperative for transparency demands it, but the implementation is still struggling with those deep-seated cultural definitions of justice.
And that leads me to the thought I want to leave everyone with. We talk about a digital single market in Europe constantly. But if France criminalizes predicting judicial behavior while Slovakia builds dashboards to rank judges based on their family trees, are we ever going to see a truly unified legal data set?
That is the big question. Can you digitize a continent that has fundamentally different definitions of what it even means to be a judge?
It seems like technology can bridge the data gap, but it might not be able to bridge the cultural one.
Not yet, at least.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
Thank you.
See you next time.
Thanks for listening to IP Management Voice. If there's any topic you'd like us to cover in this podcast or on the content platform DeepLex, please get in contact and let us know.